Next presentation will be given by Professor Fries, who is the scientific director of and CEO also of Auto21, which is a network of centers of excellence here in Canada. He's also professor of automotive engineering at the University of Windsor, and he will present us Canada's autos industry and electrical vehicles. So, Professor Fries.
Okay, well, thank you very much. C'est un grand plaisir être ici. Oh, bloody hell. Okay. There we are. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you, today about the auto industry. I'm going to say some things about electric vehicles. But to be honest with you, my real goal is to talk to you about the auto industry, because if you want to work with the auto industry, I think it's important that you understand it. Blessed Murphy. Okay, there we are. Okay. I think it's important that you understand the auto industry as it really is and not as you might wish it to be. One of my board of directors members says that everybody who's got a driver's license considers themselves to be an expert in the auto industry, and in fact, they're usually not. I'm very, very interested in Dr. Kim's presentation. She's really put her finger on the issue of electric vehicles, which is the battery. It is all about the battery. There are all kinds of other technologies that have to be incorporated into electric vehicles to make them work successfully, but if you don't have better batteries, they're really not going to be a success in the marketplace. So let's talk about Canada's place in the auto industry. Canada is a very big country. Most people don't realize it's 8,000 kilometers east to west, and it's also about 8,000 kilometers north to south. It's just about the same size north to south as it is east to west. The problem with Canada, for you people from outside of our country, is that almost everybody lives right along the U.S. border, probably 90% of Canada's population, and more than half of Canada's population lives in that little circle right there. Around 14 million people live in southern Ontario and the southern part of Quebec. And if you go north of that, it's mostly rocks and trees, and if you keep going far enough, eventually you have to learn to speak Russian or Kalashnikov. And North American headquarters of all the OEMs are not in Canada. And this may be unhappy for some people, but it's true. And nothing we do here is going to change that. And that includes all the automakers from abroad, including the Japanese, Korean, and German automakers. They're almost all in Michigan or Ohio. Honda's in Ohio, but the others are all in Michigan. And that's all that little red circle. And the place where they kind of intersect is in the middle of the Detroit River, which is about 6 kilometers away from where I live. I can see General Motors headquarters from my office. It's about a kilometer and a half away. Kilometer, maybe. Ford is about 5 kilometers away. Fiat Chrysler is about 35 kilometers away. Honda is about 100 kilometers away. Toyota is about 60 kilometers away. So it's right around there. It's nowhere else. That's where the nexus is. Canada has 12 light-duty and about 6 heavy-duty vehicle assembly plants across the country. Almost all of them are in Ontario. There are a couple of bus factories here in Quebec, and there's some truck operations elsewhere in the country. But it's almost all in southern Ontario. About 700 parts supply companies. We make about 2.5 million vehicles a year, which has gone down a little bit in the last 10 years. But our place in the world, in 2000, we were number 5 in the world. Now we're about number 11 in the world. And it's not because we make fewer vehicles. It's because others make more vehicles. China at the time was about number 25, and now they're number 1. They make more vehicles in China than they do in Germany and the U.S. put together. It's absolutely amazing. It's a huge industry. It's Canada's largest manufacturing sector. It's much, much, much bigger than the aerospace sector, probably at least five times bigger. Thanks a lot, Bob. It's about five times bigger than the aerospace industry. It's much, much bigger than the telecommunications and software industry. It's $119 billion last year and so on. It employs about 130,000 people directly and about a third of a million people indirectly. And I said to the Minister of Industry about 8 or 9 months ago that if you think Newfoundland looks poor without fish, wait till you see Southern Ontario without cars. So a lot more people and a lot less wealth. So it's quite important. These are the sort of core technology areas that Canada has some strength in. One of the interesting things about universities for you industry people is universities will always tell you that they're good at everything, and they have everything, and they know everything, and you don't need to go anywhere else, but really that's not true. Some universities are good at certain things. No university is good at everything. But if you take all of Canada's universities put together, these are the things that we're good at. So what about this global vehicle industry? It's really a huge industry. It's the largest manufacturing sector in the world, just slightly ahead of armament. So if that's a future car, what are the three things that influence people and influence the auto industry? Well, it's consumer desires. What kind of cars do people want to buy? And people will buy the car they want in a free society. People will buy the car they want. Regulations can push them one way or the other a little bit, but basically, if somebody doesn't want to buy a car, they're not going to, because it's their money, and they have a right to buy what they feel they would like to have. The government demands are important in the purchase of cars, and the industry imperatives. These are the things that the companies have to do to stay competitive, and if they don't do them, they won't be there. And that's what I said yesterday. You know, everybody always wants to know, why don't the car companies do this and why don't the car companies do that? Well, they do things because they can make money doing them, and they don't do things because they cannot make money doing them. It's as simple as that. It's really very, very simple. It's all about making money, and there's nothing wrong with that. If they don't make money, they can't stay in business and employ people, and they won't be there. So what do people want? People want a better value, and the value... A value proposition is really the ratio of performance divided by price. And you can define performance in lots of different ways, and you divide it by the price, and then you have the value proposition. And everybody tries to buy the best possible car that meets their needs at the lowest possible price. The government doesn't care about that. They want environmental performance, safety, and they want good jobs. And if you don't believe that, just watch how much money other countries and U.S. states and Mexico and so on pay to get auto plants in their country. The auto industry is one of the best creators of good jobs in the world, and that's why every government in the world wants an auto industry there. Every time I hear somebody say, you know, the auto industry is dead, let it go, that's just crazy. You know, we can't make a living selling coffee to each other. Industry imperatives. Well, industry has to build the best possible products at the lowest possible cost. They have to be flexible because different cars sell more or less at different times. Price of oil goes down, big car sales go up. Price of oil goes up, big car sales go down. And you have to have factories which can build lots of different kinds of cars, and it's very expensive to make a factory flexible. If it's not flexible, then you cannot make different kinds of cars, and that means you can't respond to the market. They also have to comply with regulations. If they don't comply with regulations, they cannot sell their products. And of course, you're seeing that right now with Volkswagen. You cannot buy a four-cylinder diesel Volkswagen anywhere in the world right now. Every government in the world has stopped the sales. In fact, Volkswagen has stopped the sales. And it's going to cost that company tens of billions of dollars to fix that problem. And it will ruin their economic future for, some people say, as much as 10 years. It's an extraordinarily serious problem for Volkswagen. And that's caused by a lack of regulatory compliance. The cars still work fine. They're not unsafe, except if you like to breathe. But the problem is that they don't comply with regulations. Okay, energy use in vehicles. Well, most of us are engineers of one stripe or another. that really the dominant factor in energy use in a vehicle is the vehicle's weight at low speed and its aerodynamics at high speed. And it doesn't matter what powers the vehicle. It doesn't matter. Electric vehicles, fuel cell, diesel, gasoline, rubber band, every vehicle in the world works like that. And driver behavior is very important. How you drive, how you maintain your vehicle. We did a survey in Canada. We found that across Canada, about 80% of the vehicles do not have their tires inflated to the correct pressure. And that makes a big, big difference to how the car handles, how safe it is in braking and turning, and how much energy it uses. 80% of the cars do not have the tires inflated properly. 80%. It's quite amazing. And what that means is that the industry is going towards lighter, sleeker vehicles that have better aerodynamics and have onboard energy-efficient systems like climate control systems, air conditioning, lighting. You're seeing LED lights and so on. Some of it's styling, but a lot of it is because LEDs use less energy for a given amount of illumination. So that is what's driving the industry right now. And it's a very difficult balance to achieve between safety, energy efficiency, and cost. You can have it safe, you can have it green, or you can have it cheap. Pick two. It's almost impossible to get all three. It's just like with the batteries. You can have it safe, you can have it powerful, you can have it fast. Which are the most important for you? It's almost impossible to get them all at once. And this constant struggle among them is really quite difficult. So I took some data here. This is very interesting. In 1983 car, the Ford Escort in 1980. I actually owned a Ford Escort in 83. It was a good little car. And 2013 Ford Focus. So that's 30 years of progress. Notice that the 2013 Focus weighs almost a third more than the Escort did. It's a much heavier car. And yet it accelerates much faster using an engine that's just about the same size. And it gets almost 50% better fuel economy. How the heck did they do that? And it actually costs less than the Escort did. Plus, it's got fuel injection, cam phasing, airbags, ABS brakes, HID headlights, air conditioning, power windows, power steering, power brakes, heated mirrors, satellite radio, Bluetooth phone. And it starts every single time, and it does not rust, and it goes around corners better, and it lasts longer, and it's cheaper. So anybody who says the auto industry is a primitive industry and has no technology is wrong. That's just ridiculous. If you don't believe me, go find a car from the 70s and try driving it. You will be amazed at how noisy and primitive it was. And at the time, we all thought they were okay. But modern cars are really pretty amazing. They actually really are. And I'm not talking about electric cars. I'm talking about a regular little car like a Focus or a Corolla or a Hyundai Soul or Kia Soul or whatever. They're really quite remarkable. But that's just not good enough because of this. And this is what you need to understand if you want to understand the auto industry. It's all about CAFE, corporate average fuel economy. That's what's making everything happen. All this stuff about electric cars and so on. Yeah, global warming is important, and I'm not minimizing the importance of global warming. But that's a side effect of the combustion of fuel. And the governments are trying to solve the problem by regulating the combustion of fuel. That's what's really going on here. And so what they're doing is they're making the car companies respond very, very much to a new target. For many years, up until 2010, the car companies had to achieve an average fuel economy across all the vehicles they sell of 27.3 miles per gallon. In 2015, it moved to just around 35 miles per gallon. This is all U.S. I'm sorry for the units. And by 2025, it's 54.5 miles per gallon. And this is a huge difference. Now, in Europe, they measure it differently. That's grams of CO2 per 100 kilometers or something like that. Grams of CO2 per kilometer. And here it's grams of CO2 per 100 kilometers, and in the U.S. it's miles per gallon. But if you do the math and the chemistry, it all works out the same. And I can show you a slide. I won't today, but I can show you a slide that shows that every country in the world including the developing countries, basically have adopted this kind of standard. So this is what's driving the car industry all over the world. The problem is, it's 100% change in 15 years. And that's after several decades of a 1% change every year or so. This is a 4 or 5% change in a year. And the auto industry is struggling with this. I'm not whining. I don't feel sorry for them. But it's not easy to do this. They've gotten to the 2016 number. That's okay. Those cars are being built. In fact, 2016 cars are built now. If you go to a showroom, you'll be buying a 2016 car. Honda launched the 2016 Civic in their Alliston, Ontario plant yesterday. The 2025 number, most of the car companies will tell you quietly, privately, they're not sure how they're going to do that. And I'll show you a slide in a minute which illustrates that. By the way, that's a bit of an oversimplification. You really should go to the U.S. Department of Energy website and download the full CAFE regulation. It's a 2,000-page PDF. You should download it and read it and memorize it. There'll be a test next week. 70 to 80% of the parts in a modern car don't come from the OEMs, they come from the parts industry. So it's not just Ford and Toyota that are responsible, it's the parts industry. Ford and Toyota figure out what the car is going to look like, they figure out they're ultimately responsible for the sale of the car, but most of the parts in the car are made by other companies, and each of those companies must contribute to the fuel economy improvement. So if I made car seats and Loic made car seats, if Pete's seats and Loic's seats are in competition, and of course we are, if Loic's seats weigh 2 kilograms less than mine do, he's going to sell seats and I won't, because now they need that 2 kilograms of weight. And there are suppliers all over the place. Around the edge of this slide, there are lists of suppliers. So, for instance, Dana makes the rear axles. ITT Friction makes the brake pads. Tesla Tape makes the hole covering patches. CTS makes the belt tension sensors, and so on and so forth. There are hundreds and hundreds of parts companies around the world contributing to the future automobile. Loic, I've given you on this machine a PDF of this presentation, so you'll have this. So what's happening in vehicle body design? Well, right now, almost every vehicle in the world has a steel body shell. Yeah, I know the Ferraris don't and the Tesla doesn't and so on, but I'm talking about cars that people like us can buy. I don't have $150,000 for a Tesla. So my cars all have steel body shell constructions. The hood of one of my cars is aluminum, but that's just because it's a sports car. You're going to see a lot of optimization in steel body shell construction, and that's happening now. And there are all kinds of different grades of steel in modern cars. You'll see some aluminum used. More and more of aluminum is being used. You'll find the Ford F-150 has an aluminum body structure. It's really quite remarkable, that vehicle. Steel space frames may be coming along. Carbon fiber reinforced polymers, although that's very expensive and it's a very slow production process. If you go to a big modern assembly plant, let's say you go to Windsor Assembly where they make the Dodge Caravan minivan and the Chrysler Town and Country, every 42 seconds another car goes by. Less than 1 minute, every 42 seconds. And so you cannot make carbon fiber parts that fast. You just can't do it, aside from the materials cost. So that's why you don't see a lot of carbon fiber parts on high production cars. So this slide came from Volkswagen. It's very interesting. You should see what that is in German. It's really great. Okay, aluminum. What's going on here? Well, there's the Land Rover. It's a very high-end, expensive vehicle. They took over 900 pounds out of the Land Rover by using aluminum in from one model year to the next, over 900 pounds. And that's an amazing reduction in weight. It's absolutely huge. This is how vehicles use materials, and this is data going back 25 years to 30 years now, from 1985 to 2010. Ferrous metals, that's iron and steel, non-ferrous metals like aluminum, bronze, copper, things like that, plastics, rubber, glass, fluids, and other materials, and so on. And you can see that it really didn't change very much over those 25 years. And it has only just started to change in the last year or so now. Non-ferrous metals are going up, ferrous metals are going down a little bit, and that trend will continue. But by 2025, that trend cannot. It can't look like that. It can't. Because the cars would weigh too much, and there's no way they could get that kind of fuel economy, no matter what engines they had. So things are going to change a lot. So if you have friends in the materials industries, they're going to do well in the next decade or so. You're going to see all kinds of other innovations to use less energy in the car. This is one that we've been working on with Magna. It's called Acoustivision. It's where instead of having stereo speakers all over the car, you use the window with some electromechanical drivers to move the window, and that is the speaker of the stereo. And you wouldn't believe how well it works. It sounds weird, but it really works extremely well. There are no speakers in the car. It's just the window, and it can reproduce all the sounds that it needs to. And people say, well, doesn't it distort the vision? Well, the motion is about... it's about a tenth of a millimeter, so it's about 4/1000ths of an inch. So you can't see it at all. If you put your fingers on it, you can feel it buzzing a little bit, but it has no effect at all on the vision. And it weighs almost 30 pounds less than conventional speakers. It's much easier to put the car together because you don't have to have wires all over the car. And that's the electric driver right there, that thing there. It's about 30 centimeters long and about 3 centimeters thick and 3 centimeters wide, and the window has two of them mounted on the bottom edge, along the bottom edge of the window, and the top edge is just a hinge. The window goes into it and just moves around like that. Works great. And they built a Ford Crown Victoria that way, and they built a BMW with the front windshield and the back window done that way, and it sounded even better.
So good outside too.
Pardon me? You can hear, it's not that bad outside. It's because the air is contained inside the car. It's no worse than some of the idiots you see on the street going down the street with their stereos blasting. In fact, it's quieter than that. It's actually a pretty good system. It works very well. So this is the interesting slide. Now, I don't expect you to read it right now, but here you have two large global companies. They're very sophisticated companies. And Nissan is basically saying, hybrid. Stupid idea. We're not doing that. Hybrid's bad. We're not doing hybrids. And you have Toyota saying battery vehicles, waste of time, not going that way. We're not doing that. And so you have these two companies facing exactly the same problem. They're in exactly the same markets all over the world, and they're going two different ways. And what this tells you is that the world's auto industry is still not sure how to solve all these problems. And a lot of them have to do with the batteries from Dr. Kim's talk, but a lot of them have to do with other materials in the car and other forms of powertrain. So there is no single easy solution. And it costs hundreds of billions of dollars to do this R&D. And that's why when people talk about, well, why doesn't Canada's car industry do this? Do you know how many cars are sold in Canada per year? About 1.6 million. So if you take 1.6 million and you divide it into 100 billion, the extra cost per car would be huge. You could never pay for it with a small market like Canada. That's why the Swedish car companies are both in trouble. Well, Saab is gone now. That's why. It's because the Swedish market is just too small. Even the European market isn't big enough. That's why the car companies are consolidating, because they can't afford to do all the R&D if the market is split up into little pieces like it has been. So you're seeing Fiat and Chrysler joining, and there's now talk of Fiat and Chrysler and General Motors joining, although General Motors doesn't want to do that. I'm not sure why anybody would want to join General Motors. But anyway, the point is that you know, the amounts of money involved are gigantic, and it's almost impossible to finance it without having huge market scale. So even giant companies like Volkswagen and Toyota and General Motors and so on are having a very tough time. The smaller companies like Honda and BMW are having a really bad time. And this is the fundamental problem, and Dr. Kim will be familiar with this figure. This is the energy content in kilowatt hours per kilogram. At the top is gasoline and diesel with around 12 kilowatt hours per kilogram, and then you have various other fuels like ethanol, liquid natural gas, coal, compressed natural gas, hydrogen, and so on. And down at the bottom, at nearly zero, are lithium batteries. That's the problem. And until that problem gets solved, electric vehicles are going to struggle because they're just not as good as internal combustion engine cars at going down the highway, pulling up hills, hauling trailers to the cottage, and so on. They're just not. And that's the problem. Everybody who buys an electric car is making a compromise, and they're paying more for it. And that's why the sales of electric cars are so low. I'm not anti-electric car, but you know, we all have to be realistic and have adult conversations about what the problem is. And Dr. Kim has identified them precisely. And the lithium battery, the lithium battery that we have today is nearly at the limit of its development. It's not going to get that much better. And it's still nowhere near as good as gasoline and diesel. And everybody in the marketplace knows that. And the final say from Sergio Marchione, I hope you don't, you know, on the Fiat 500e, I hope you don't buy one, because every time you do, it costs me $14,000. That's the problem. Nobody can make money with these cars. They only build them because they have to, not because they want to. And it's not because they don't like electric cars, it's because they don't like losing money, and they can't do it for long. So, one change direction now and talk about what it's like to work with the auto industry and work in the auto industry. The auto industry follows a very disciplined process because the amounts of money involved are huge. We're talking billions of dollars to do almost anything. If you remember back, Ford used to build a minivan called the Windstar. It was a pretty good van, and it was built in Oakville, Ontario. And then a few years later, they came out with a new model called the Freestar. And from 100 feet away, you couldn't tell the two apart. They really looked the same. But it cost over $1 billion to make that design change. And when Chrysler put the stow-in-the-floor seats in the minivan, from the outside, you can't tell any difference in the car at all. There's a little badge on the B-pillar beside the driver's shoulder here. It says stow-and-go, and it's a little badge about the size of a postage stamp. That was a $700 million investment to do that. $700 million. That's enough to run a big university for 2 years. So, you know, the amounts of money involved are huge. It takes a long time to do this stuff. The battery research that Dr. Kim and her group are doing costs a huge amount of money. It takes a long time to do it properly, make sure things are safe, that they're going to last, that they're durable, that they won't have warranty problems down the road, and so on and so forth. That's why things take so long in the auto industry, because it's so big and so complicated. So this is a typical meeting in an auto industry company, and a typical OEM program engineer, and he's talking about his program, and he's saying, okay, then we'll have to build a second prototype to do some other tests, and then somebody points out to him that the second prototype is not in the budget, and then he is eaten. And that's what happens in these companies. And they have special rooms in Detroit, Tokyo, and Seoul, and Munich, and Stuttgart, where they have these meetings. And these rooms are very easy to clean because they're very bloody meetings. And I'm only being a little bit funny. I've been in some of these meetings, and you just wouldn't believe it. If somebody makes a mistake, it's not a $100 mistake. It's a $100 million mistake. And it can ruin a company. They try very hard not to make too many mistakes, and they don't take a lot of chances because they just can't afford it. Okay, now, how do you work in this industry? Well, you have to have some attributes. You've got to have values, attitude, behavior, and fit. If you have a bad attitude and no skills, you will be leaving. You can't stay. If you have an okay attitude and not too good skills, might be all right for a while. In order to be a success in the auto industry, you have to have great skills and a great attitude. You have to work really hard. It's a very hard industry. Most of my students graduate and work in the auto industry. In fact, probably 80% of them. And the ones who don't stay are the ones with a problem on this chart. And I can pick them out when they're in about second year, who's not going to make it. This is the number of auto workers in the workforce. The Australian number is wrong. It's now migrating down towards zero because last year, just like that, the Australian government changed the trade regulations in Australia, and within about 6 weeks, Toyota announced that they were pulling out, Ford announced that they were pulling out, and General Motors announced that they were pulling out, and that's all the cars that are made in Australia. So within another 18 months or so, Australia will not have an auto industry, and that number will be just about zero. And that's the kind of thing that could happen in our country if the government were to do something dumb. Really. The only reason to make cars in Canada is because you can make money making cars in Canada. They don't want to make cars in Canada. They want to make money. If they can't make money, they won't do it. It's as simple as that. So this 4.67 million figure is the total size of the workforce. It includes unskilled people, skilled people, technical people like engineering people like us, marketing people, managerial staff, and so on. The discussion I have today will just be confined to the technical workforce, the engineers and technologists and so on. So in the old days, you would have a product engineer. So you'd have an engineer in charge of the engine design for a certain model car. And that person and his group or her group would be responsible for the conceptual design of the product. And then they would sort of, and you've probably heard this expression, the older people in the group will have heard this expression, you throw the drawings over the wall. And the drawings go over the wall to the manufacturing people, to the drafting people who draw the parts, and to the engineering and analysis people who do the analysis. And they come up with a manufacturing plan and a component geometry and a specification compliance plan and so on. And they all have to communicate back and forth and make sure that the parts that the guys in the drafting department are designing are actually the parts that are going to fit with the other guys' parts in the other departments. And eventually you get to a component. The problem is there's so much communication required between people, and in those days it was all done on paper, that every once in a while you'd have something that didn't fit. And there was a Ford model that was done about 15 years ago called the Contour. And the first prototype engines of the Ford Contour and the prototype transmissions for that car had different bell housing patterns. So they couldn't bolt together. It was like building a room with no door. Looks okay until you try to get in or out. It just doesn't work. So that's the kind of screw-up that could happen. And, of course, that could be $100 million because you'd have to change all the tooling and redo all the analysis and the testing, so on and so forth. And so those kinds of messes cannot happen anymore. They cost too much money and they take too long. So lots of problems there. And, of course, because 70 to 80% of the parts in the car come from other companies, you have to have a way of communicating with those other companies that makes certain that they have the same information that you do and that this company is talking to that company and they're also talking to me, the OEM, to make sure that all the parts come together at the right time and they all fit and work together. And it's very difficult because there's so much technology on the car. So this is what's happening now. The product engineer sort of comes up with the conceptual design of the component just like before. I mean, somebody has to be in charge because somebody has to decide we're doing this and we're not doing that. And then they communicate with manufacturing engineering people and engineering analysis people, but the key person is in the middle, and that's the design engineer. It's not a technologist job. These people don't come from community colleges. They come from universities, and they're very, very skilled people, and they handle the geometry, the specification compliance, and the manufacturing plan, and they use the manufacturing and the analysis people as kind of internal consultants. And so there's lots of communication, but it's all done electronically using electronic database drawings from big drawing packages like CATIA and Unigraphics and SG and things like that. And so you don't have a lot of paper shuffling around. And quite often the design team is spread around the world, so you'll have people doing the conceptual design in Detroit, and their analysis team is actually in Pune in India, and those guys are running the jobs at night when the Detroit people are asleep, and then when the Detroit people come back in the morning, the Indian guys have emailed the analysis back to them, and everybody can check the stresses and make sure that things are all right. And that kind of stuff is going on all the time. And all of the big companies have analysis groups in other parts of the world, and it's specifically to take advantage of labor cost differences in the world and as well to take advantage of the 24-hour clock. Most people in the auto industry would prefer a 30-hour clock, but that's not likely unless the world gets further away from the sun. So that's how it's done now. And the problem is there's so many parts in a car. A car has 5,000 to 7,000 parts, and every single one of them has to be designed, specified, manufactured. It has to be tested to make sure it's compliant. Somebody has to accept it at the warehouse and catalog it and keep track of it, and it has to be warrantied for 10 years after the thing is built, and so on. Look at the running boards on this SUV, and I picked them because they look like such simple things. Those running boards on those SUVs have somewhere between 40 and 60 separate components. Every single one of them has to be designed and developed by somebody. Oh, you're cutting me off? Yeah, sure. Okay, so what that means is that your company will have a capability inventory of human resources, physical infrastructure, what kind of machinery do you have, and how big is your factory, and so on, and supplier capabilities. And that's a part of the capability of your company, are the capabilities of all of your suppliers. And you as engineers, and I'm speaking to the younger engineers now, you have to be aware of all of those things. What can your company do and what can it not do? And if you start designing a product that goes outside of the capability of your company, you are making a big strategic decision for your company, and you better tell your boss about it. For instance, if you're in a company which specializes in steel parts, and you say, I think I'm going to do this thing out of aluminum, that's a couple of clicks on your CAD terminal to just change the material. But that's a huge difference in the strategic direction of your company, because welding aluminum is completely different from welding steel and forming aluminum and painting it. You need different suppliers. The guys that make steel do not make aluminum. They make steel. So you need new suppliers. You got to go talk to new people, take them out for lunch, and so on and so forth. And young designers quite often make those very big decisions for their companies, and their bosses don't even know it. And that's when projects go out of control. So communication among the engineering group is very, very important. How do we educate young engineers? How do we reach out to industry? These are important questions for those of us who work and study the auto industry. Auto 21 has been this great partnership for the last 15 years, $5.8 million a year. All the activities are supported by other organizations, other companies. We are never the sole source of support for anything. We've worked with more than 500 professors. Actually, that number's wrong. It's 2,800 students, 2,800 now. This is some of the statistics. We've done over $150 million worth of work since 2001. It's been a very big program, and it's been very good. We have never had a legal problem. We've never had a serious dispute about intellectual property. It's been, I think, quite successful. And there we are. That's my presentation. Thank you. If I don't get a question, I'm going to pick a volunteer.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your very interesting presentation. You presented there a slide about Fiat, saying that they didn't want people to buy the cars because they were losing money.
Right.
I read some articles some time ago about BMW that were probably making money with i3, their electric vehicle, if they sold up to 20,000 model cars.
Yeah.
What's your general idea about this? I guess Tesla's not losing money now, maybe.
Tesla?
Yeah.
Tesla is a stock play. It's
well, okay, you are talking about the whole market, but
yeah.
What's the breakpoint of the electric vehicles? Do you think people are selling them with losses, generally speaking?
Okay,
big losses, or that Fiat company was maybe exaggerating a
little? No, they're not. So There's two important regulations that the car companies have to meet, and I only talked about one of them. One of them is CAFE, Corporate Average Fuel Economy, and I oversimplified it here. It's much more complicated than I showed you. The numbers are correct, but they have to count all the vehicles that they sell and how many of each vehicle they sell, and then they do a sort of a running average of the fuel economy of all those vehicles. It's very, very complicated. And they get credits for certain things like certain kinds of air conditioning and certain kinds of tires and stuff like that. It's a great big hairy mess. So that's CAFE. But then there's another whole set of regulations that they also have to comply with called ZEV, Zero Emissions Vehicle Mandate. And that's something that the state of California has had, and some other U.S. states have adopted the same thing. What that says is, and you have to listen carefully, you must offer a vehicle for sale which has zero emissions. That's what the ZEV mandate says. It doesn't say you have to sell any of them. It just says you have to offer them for sale. Okay? And that's what Sergio's talking about there. We have the Fiat 500e. It is zero emissions. You can buy one. But I hope you don't. Because every time I sell one of those goddamn things, I lose $14,000. So I'd rather you just didn't buy it. But I do have them for sale, so I comply with the ZEV mandate. If I don't comply with the ZEV mandate, I can't sell anything in California. And California is the largest single jurisdiction car market in the world. More people live in California than live in Canada. More people live in California than live in Canada, and every one of them's got at least one car. Some of them have four or five cars. So if you can't sell cars in California, you're going to lose, in English we would say, you will lose your shirt. Your business will just die. So if California says you have to have a car with zero emissions, fine, we'll have a car with zero emissions. I don't want to sell any of them because they cost too much money. I can't sell a Fiat 500 for the money it would cost me to build one. It might cost $60,000 to build a Fiat 500. Who's going to pay $60,000 for that car? Nobody. Nobody. So I put them on at a loss. I hope I don't sell too many because I cost too much, but at least I comply with the rules. That's what's going on there.
But, excuse me.
Thank you for the presentation. And we look for the next VPC conference chair.